And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I am John McKenzie and I'm joined, as always, by my good friend and producer, Mike Zimmerman. Mike, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, John. How are you?
I am doing really well because we've just had a brilliant recording with our good pal, a fellow TIFO employee, Abhishek Raj, talking all about football finances. And I know you enjoyed this podcast episode as well. So what did you enjoy most about it?
I think for me, it's when we look at football clubs and finances, we kind of look at it from a backseat view where we don't know the inner workings of kind of clubs' balance sheets, raising money. And I think Abhishek kind of, when people listen to this, I think they're going to get a real insight of exactly how complex these finances are within the clubs. So I'm actually looking forward to hearing what these listeners think and what they take away from it. But I think that for me, it was, wow, there's so much more going on than meets the eye, because we're so used to seeing you know, these transfer fees and all that, but we don't necessarily see the wages and we don't necessarily see all the different leagues' rules because, you know, Abhishek talks about how La Liga has different rules for Barcelona than maybe, say, you know, Premier League has for Manchester United and Chelsea. So I think for me, that's what's really interesting, and Abhishek dives really deep into that.
Yeah, and we've touched on, I think, the big points of football finance, the big clubs that are in the public eye at the moment. So we talk about Manchester United, we talk about Barcelona, we talk about Chelsea, and we talk about Arsenal, and there's plenty of things to get excited about there, I think, particularly if you're an Arsenal fan. So yeah, if you're an Arsenal fan, stick around for some good news at the end. But I think without further ado, let's just jump straight into the episode. So we're joined by a very exciting guest today. We are joined by Abhishek Raj. Abhishek, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, John. It's very good to be here.
Now, by day, Abhishek is an associate partner at Bain & Company, a management consultancy firm. But by night, he's a freelance writer for TIFO, and he focuses on the financial side of football, which is exactly what we're going to talk about today, because football finance is clearly a massive aspect of the modern game. At the time of recording, which I should say is July the 14th, nearly £2 billion have been spent this window in the big five European leagues, according to the Guardian website. So that is going to be our topic today. We're going to talk all things football finance. So what you should have to look forward to in this episode are how to assess the financial health of a football club, Manchester United's takeover, Barcelona's ongoing mess, what are Chelsea doing, and how can Arsenal afford all of these players? But let's begin by asking a general question, because Abhishek, we've got your expertise on the show today, so I wanted to pose to you a few general questions about how it is that you assess the financial health of a football team. So can you just talk to us a little bit about what your process is when you're trying to assess how well a team are doing on the financial side of things?
Yeah, that's a great question, John. And actually, it's a good place to start, because I think as we go into specific clubs, you'll actually see specific elements of this list of things that I'm going to talk about come to life. So broadly, I look at four things. Two of them are related to the operating performance of the club, which is kind of the day-to-day footballing performance, financial footballing performance. And two are more forward-looking, related to kind of planning and how clubs think about transfers and their sources of funds and things like that. So the first two, which are more operating day-to-day, I'm going to start with revenue. And I look at two things here. I actually look at the revenue mix, which is across the three broad streams of revenue. So if I define that as match day income, broadcasting income and commercial income, which are the three broad revenue streams for a football club, is there actually a good, healthy mix between the three? That's a sign of a fairly healthy, stable football club. Bayern Munich are actually a very good example of this, where they have a fairly steady 15-20% match day income, 30-35% broadcasting income, 50-55% commercial income mix, which has actually stayed stable for the last decade. The second thing I look at on revenue is growth. which is year on year, how is the revenue actually growing? Now, obviously, revenue is choppy. There are good years where clubs win trophies and they get more. And then there are not so good years, right? But even given that, over a 5 to 7 year period, I look at a 9 to 10% revenue growth and say that's pretty healthy. 9 to 10% each year, that is. Again, Bayern Munich, a good example. They've grown at 9% every year over the last decade. So that's great. The second thing I look at day to day. So as I said, those are the two on revenue, which is mix and growth. The second day to day element is wages. Specifically on wages, I look at three things. The wage cap, which is the maximum wage paid to a single player at the club. The wage distribution, which is the spread of wages across the squad. And the wage inflation, which is actually the growth in the overall wage bill or squad cost, however you want to define it, over the years, right? Now, the flip side of this is when this goes wrong, this is actually the first indicator of poor financial health and leads to subsequent issues financially for football clubs, right? So a common mistake we see here is when new owners come into football clubs and they think they can actually change the wage structure overnight, bring in a lot of top players and just completely disrupt the squad harmony because the spread in the wages is just too high. Queen's Park Rangers are actually a good example of this, where this happened and, well, not good example as it turns out, of where this happened and didn't go so well. I actually think Manchester City and Bayern Munich, again, are good examples of clubs that have managed this well. So they have a healthy wage cap, decent wage distribution for clubs that are challenging for domestic titles and Champions Leagues. Wage inflation, again, this is choppy because obviously players come and go, wages go down, go up. But you want, ideally, over a 5 to 7 year period, again, the wage inflation to be slightly slower than the revenue growth. So if the revenue growth number we spoke about was 9 to 10% each year, I would want wage inflation to be 7 to 8% at most, right? Slightly less than that. Arsenal are actually a good example of a club that have managed this really well. They haven't played Champions League football for the last 5 years. 2016-17 was the last time they were in the Champions League. So they realized very quickly they would need to manage down costs smartly. And they've actually done that quite well. So Arsenal's, we'll talk about Arsenal spending obviously later, John, but one of the reasons why they can is because they've actually managed the wages really well. So their wage to turnover is 58%, which is actually very low. Perfect. So those are the two day-to-day ones. And the two longer-term ones, the first one is transfer effectiveness. So here again, I look at on the buying side as well as the selling side. On the selling side, it's fairly simple. You look at income from player sales. And this is a fairly simple metric. It's tracked quite well and clubs report it, obviously. And it's a good indicator of whether clubs are actually able to move players on successfully. On the buying side, it's a little trickier because obviously you can argue there are various ways to value players. And if you really want to be at the top, you sometimes have to pay very high valuations for players. Having said that, I think there are a few things that stand out. Firstly, the footballing structure at a club, specifically around recruitment, it's a good indicator of this. So are they able to actually find players who are near the end of their contracts, for example, at the current club, which would obviously reduce the valuation at which they can be bought? Are they able to solve for the future by actually building a squad which has a good balance between current top players or first team players and actually players who can come into it organically over a period of time and therefore they would be cheaper if you buy them younger? Clubs that recruit actually very smartly from the lower leagues or from other parts of Europe, maybe the French league, the Belgian league, or the Portuguese league, for example, very smartly identifying players that fit roles in that team that maybe don't have as high valuation today. The fourth element, again, more forward-looking long-term, is debt and finance cost. Again, here, it's talked about a lot. Debt is almost like a bad word in the football community. But I don't actually think debt by itself is bad, right? So there are two things to ask when you look at debt for a football club. The first is, why did they actually raise the debt? What are they using it for? I generally feel like if you're raising debt for physical assets, which is like to buy a stadium, for example, or to improve the training ground and training infrastructure, I think that's great, actually, right? So debt for capital investment is usually a good thing because you're actually creating a revenue-generating asset that's a long-term revenue-generating asset, right? Tottenham Hotspur's new stadium is actually a very good example of that. Debt raised for the building of a strong commercial asset. Debt raised purely for player transfers is a little more risky because you're not necessarily sure that will actually lead to revenue growth or additional revenue going forward, especially if that money is not spent wisely. And we'll talk about a few examples of that. And then, of course, there is debt raised effectively for the privilege of having the Glazers as the owners of a football club. We'll talk about that as well shortly, right? The second thing is how much does that debt cost? Because if you're raising debt at, say, bank loan interest rates, that's great. That's fantastic. And usually long-term debt, which is 20, 25 years long, like the Tottenham debt, for example, on the stadium, it's actually well-financed in that it's not a very high interest rate per year. And actually, you're giving it enough time then for the stadium to grow and achieve full potential. And the additional earning that the stadium creates more than compensates the interest payment. So that's actually well-structured debt, I would say. Whereas, again, I go back to the Manchester United takeover because it unfortunately is a good example of debt badly done. Hedge fund loans or payment in kind loans are actually very dangerous debt. So what does that mean? Hedge fund loans come in at very high interest rates. So if a bank loan is at 4-5% per year, a hedge fund loan would be 15-16% per year. So that's already three times as much interest that you're paying. And secondly, payment in kind loans are basically where you're paying off the interest by taking more debt effectively. So it's a dangerous thing because it cascades over time. And again, when Manchester United were bought, a lot of those loans were payment in kind loans. So these are the four things, John, at the highest level that I look at. And it can actually reveal a lot about football clubs. And as we go through, I'll actually refer back to this and highlight where specific elements come through for the clubs we talk about.
Yeah, you've mentioned a lot of metrics there. How easy is it for you to get hold of this data? Is it easily available for just public individuals?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So the good thing is actually for the larger clubs, the larger Premier League, most of the Premier League clubs actually, they report a lot of this. So even if they're not actually publicly listed companies, Manchester United, of course, is publicly listed. So they would have a lot more information. They'd have analysts writing about it. There'd be a lot on clubs like that. But even privately owned entities like a Manchester City actually release fairly elaborate financial statements. So when you go through it, you can usually find these metrics quite easily, right? The other thing that I would I would actually strongly urge people to do is go and just I guess once you have your list of metrics, just literally Google the club with the metrics that you want to find. You'll actually find a lot of these things on the club's websites. So it may be in an investor presentation, for example, Barcelona release investor presentations that are quite detailed, maybe somewhere else, but you get a lot of this information through sort of smart secondary research as well.
So that's all of the theory stuff. Let's move on to the much more interesting practical side of things. And you've mentioned Manchester United, you've mentioned debt. So let's get into that. So at the moment, Manchester United are quite interesting because they are currently in the process of going through a takeover bid. So the Glazers announced that they put the club on the market back in November of last year. And then since then, there's been two leading candidates in the race to buy this side. So we've got on the one hand, the Qatari billionaire Sheikh Jassim bin Hamad Al Thani, who's lodged a bid which could see him buy 100% of the club, and then that would mean that the Glazers would be out, whereas Sir Jim Ratcliffe, the chief of Ineos, he's put up a 60% offer on the table, and that would keep the door open for the Americans to remain a little bit. So I think the big question we should be asking is, why is it that the Glazers have decided to sell at this point in time?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the right question to ask, and that's the right place to start. I think it's good to actually first set a little bit of context around the Glazer ownership and the rationale for why they actually bought Manchester United in the first place. The Glazers very much have, pretty much through their entire ownership, have looked at Manchester United as a cash-generating machine. That's basically what it is to them. So when they originally bought the club, they took a lot of debt to get that deal over the line. So a lot of this, of course, has been extensively written and spoken about, but briefly, it was a leveraged buyout, which means they took Manchester United's debt overnight from 110 million to 660 million. And it's almost like saying I bought a car by borrowing money on the car. So the asset that you bought actually has to pay back the debt, right? So it's literally just debt taken for the privilege of having the Glazers as owners. Now, they've obviously got a lot of money out of Manchester United over the last 15, 16 years. But if you look at now, right, the time now, it's actually an interesting time in a few different ways. And that's why they're actually looking for investment. Now, they've actually been looking for an investor since 2019, John. That's when they started the hunt, the end of 2019, around December 2019. It's been a couple of years now, it's 3 years now, and they haven't actually been able to find an investor for a very simple reason. No investor effectively wants to buy a minority stake in Manchester United, where the Glazers will be running the club day to day. It's almost like paying money for a car that someone else is going to drive. So you want controlling stake, right? And that's been the issue so far in the hunt that they've had. But they also haven't been looking very seriously until very recently. Why did they start looking seriously recently? A few reasons. One, if you look at the cash generating engines of Manchester United, let's look at match day income, broadcasting and commercial. Commercial revenue has actually been flat for the last 5 years. It's going to marginally go up next year, I think, but otherwise, for the 5 years before that, it's basically been flat, right? So that's the first engine and healthy engine for Manchester United, which is actually now tapped out a little bit. The second is broadcasting income. Now, broadcasting or TV income is actually directly proportional to how well the club's actually doing in both domestic competition as well as European competition. Manchester United haven't had the best 5 years domestically or in Europe, right? So obviously that's also another stream of revenue which is not firing as strongly as it potentially could. The third stream of revenue there is matchday income, where again, they're facing an issue now because Old Trafford's reached levels where it needs serious investment, right? So if I think about it from the Glazer perspective, they're basically saying, look, we have two choices. One, we significantly invest behind the club now, specifically the stadium. Now, remember, if Old Trafford needs investment, they have to move to another stadium. So there'll be a transition period. Matchday income will probably drop and then pick up again over time. And they'll have to raise debt to actually reinvest the stadium. Now, if you do that, you're basically committing another 10, 15 years as owners of the club, because otherwise you won't actually see the return on that investment. You make the investment, but then somebody else will see the return. So they weren't inclined to commit to that kind of duration. That's the first hypothesis. Again, we're all hypothesizing, but that seems a fairly reliable hypothesis in my head, because the Glazers have always looked at United, as I said, as a cash engine. If the cash dries up, it's probably a good time. The second thing that's happened here is they've seen what's happened with the Chelsea sale, which was actually a distressed sale, but happened at $2.5 billion of valuation, right? Now, that's a 5x revenue multiple on what was a distressed sale, right? Which means basically the sellers didn't really have as much leverage, negotiating leverage, right? If I apply the same 5x multiple to Manchester United's revenue, that's already between 3 and 4 billion pounds. And if I think about it from the Glazers' perspective, they don't really have to sell. So they actually have more negotiating leverage. So the way they're thinking about it is the Chelsea valuation actually set the floor in some sense. And if the floor is 3 to 4 billion, as I said, based on Manchester United's revenue, they are thinking if we get 5, 6, 7 billion for this, it's fantastic, right? The third thing I think that's happened, John, if you look at it, the last, I would say, year, maybe 2 years, we've seen a lot of interest both from American owners or potential owners, as well as other parts of the world, right? The Middle East, especially, in actually owning Premier League clubs. Now, that may not be purely for the club as an asset. It may be for other reasons, but whatever the motivations, there is a lot of interest that's come up now. And I think the Glazers are very, very aware of this. They saw Liverpool also publicly declare that they were looking potentially for investment. And they said, hey, hang on, if Chelsea have been sold, Liverpool have declared interest, we better move quickly, because the number of people who can afford Manchester United is finite, right? And that actually triggered the acceleration of the process. They hired the same investment company that managed the Chelsea sale to manage the process for them. This is the Rain Investment Group. And that's why they're looking to sell effectively.
We've talked a lot there about valuation. I think this is quite an interesting topic. Because as you mentioned, there are a lot of American investors coming in to buy clubs at the moment. And the idea, I suppose, would be that they see clubs as assets which will increase in value over time. So we saw Todd Boehly and Clear Lake Capital buying Chelsea with the idea that, you know, they can multiply the value of that club in a short space of time. So let's talk a little bit about how you would value Manchester United and whether or not you think that buying a club like Manchester United can actually work out as a profit-making enterprise?
Yeah, that's, a very relevant question to ask, and also why the Glazers are holding out, right, for larger bids. So there are three or four ways that I would look at valuing Manchester United, John. So the first is the most obvious one, perhaps, is just to use the share price. So if I look at the current share price, it's about $22.80. Manchester United have 165 million outstanding shares. So that simple math gets us to about $3.7 billion or about 2.9 to 3 billion pounds. Right? So that's the first approach, which is just basically market capitalization based on the share price. The second approach is what we call enterprise value. So basically I take the same market capitalization I just calculated and I add what's called net financial debt. Now, what is net financial debt? It basically means the gross financial debt of the club less the cash balance. Basically, you take out the cash from it, right? So Manchester United have a gross financial debt as per the latest financials they released of 725 million pounds and a cash balance of 75 million pounds. So effectively, that's a net financial debt of 650 million pounds, which I would add then to the market capitalization of 2.9 to 3. It gets me to about 3.6 to 3.7 billion pounds. That's the second approach to value United. The third that I would look at is what we call a multiples approach in the industry. So effectively, you could do this based on profit or based on revenue. For football clubs, profit is generally not as reliable a metric for various reasons. One, a lot of football clubs actually are negative profit, so you can't even use profit multiples. Secondly, profits can actually be manipulated artificially through player amortization. We'll talk about Chelsea in a bit, and we'll talk about how that works. Revenue, by contrast, is always positive, and it's actually less easy to mess with, right? So revenue is a more sort of stable metric generally over time and a more reliable metric to use. So we'll use revenue multiples, right? Manchester United, as I said, there are many ways you could think about the revenue multiple. If you look at historical sales of Premier League clubs and top Premier League clubs, the revenue multiples used have been between sort of 2 and 3. But I guess the Chelsea sale is the right base to look at, right? Because that's the most recent one. And Chelsea sale actually was at a revenue multiple, as I said, of 5, right? So 5 times. So Chelsea's revenue was £480 million. They were sold for £2.5 billion. So it's about a 5.2-ish multiple. If I apply exactly that number to Manchester United's revenue outlook for 22-23, which is £640 million, that again gets me to about 3 to 3.2-ish billion pounds, right, as the number. So whichever way you come at it, we basically land somewhere between £3 and £4 billion as the actual commercial worth of Manchester United as a financial asset. But again, the trick with valuation is a club's always worth as much as someone's willing to pay for it. Right. And if I think about who's bidding, right, let's talk about Sheikh Jassim, for example. Manchester United may be worth way more actually to him than just the footballing assets of the club or even the financial elements that come from the football club itself. It could be a way to put Qatar on the global map. It could be Qatari tourism. There could be various underlying motivations there that actually make it financially viable. So if you ask me purely from a financial perspective, Manchester United is probably not worth more than £3 to £4 billion, right? And if you look at noteworthy other secondary sources, like Forbes, for example, valued Manchester United at £3.7 billion. Bloomberg actually did their own discounted cash flow model where they modeled Manchester United's cash flows and said it's actually not worth more than £2 billion, right? So there's a wide range you see there, but no one's actually gone beyond this £3 to £4 billion number. So that's probably the most, well, optimistic range of valuation if you look at it purely as a financial asset. But again, you hear the Glazers are holding out for more than £5, more than £6 billion. And the reason probably is they know what it's worth to the people bidding.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
We should talk a little bit about the Glazers in more detail because you've mentioned debt and the Glazers are very unpopular around Manchester. So could you talk to us a little bit about why that is the case and the financial underpinnings in particular of that?
Yeah. So, John, actually, I think two stats summarize exactly why the Glazers are so unpopular better than anything else I could come up with. The first is, over the 16 years of Glazer ownership, Manchester United have paid £750 million in interest payments. The other 19 Premier League clubs put together in the same period of time have paid £850 million in interest payments. So Manchester United alone have paid 90% as much interest as the other 19 clubs put together in that period of time. And the bigger problem, as I said, with this is, what are they even paying the interest for? It's actually not to build a new stadium. It's not to even buy players, right? Because the transfer debt is a whole separate other beast that we haven't talked about, right? The debt is literally because of the original debt taken to finance the Glazer ownership of the club. So it's almost like Manchester United are paying most of their interest for the privilege of having the Glazers as owners, right? So that's the first issue here. And that's rightfully why Manchester United fans, there's a lot of anger towards the Glazers because of that. The second stat is, if I look at net owner funding over the last 10 years, right? And I'm defining that as loans received from owners, share capital received from owners where owners have bought shares, and I'm taking out any dividends that their owners have taken, because obviously that's negative, owners taking money out of the club. If I look at Manchester City, it's £515 million in the last 10 years. And remember, Manchester City were bought 15 years ago. So it's not like the last 10 years were the first 10 years of the ownership, right? It was 5 years into the ownership of Sheikh Mansour, right? But still, £515 million for Manchester City, £580 million for Chelsea in the last 10 years. This includes both Abramovich as well as the Bowley Clear Lake Consortium. Everton, Farhad Moshiri, £680 million put into the club in the last 10 years. If I look at Manchester United, it's minus £175 million, right? And that is minus £20 million because of a share buyback. A share buyback is effectively where they made the club buy shares back from them and paid them themselves £20 million. And minus £155 million in dividends. So the Glazers have effectively taken out £175 million from the club. And in the same time, Sheikh Mansour has pumped £515 million into Manchester City. So if you think about the levels of the two clubs, it's almost like United are trying to compete with an arm and two fingers behind their backs, right? Held behind their backs in this fight against Man City. And that's another reason why there's a lot of frustration and a lot of anger towards the Glazers, right? So these two metrics, in my opinion, really kind of epitomize Glazer ownership. They haven't put any of their own money into the club. They've taken out a lot of money because, as I said, that was the primary motivation to own the club in the first place. And now they're delaying the sale process, which is actually a little like inexplicable. So despite the bids being actually quite strong, right? If you look at the reporting done by The Athletic, it's upwards of 5 billion. Sheikh Jassim's bid close to 6 billion if you think about the investment into the community, but they're still holding out.
This may be potentially a stupid question, but obviously from a footballing side, that approach to a football club is not great. But it seems like from a financial point of view, the Glazers have made a lot of money out of Manchester United. And so my question would be, why do we not see more owners approach club ownership in that way by leveraging it, using debt and then basically creaming off the dividends? Is it simply the case that there's only a very few clubs where that would work for them?
Yeah, that's an interesting question and a good one, John. So I think the first good thing that I want to call out is leverage buyouts are now no longer allowed to buy a football club. So that's great, actually, right? And the Manchester United sale to the Glazers shouldn't have gone through in its original form the way it did. So it's good to see that that's now not going to happen. And I also think that it's good that now there is a tighter due diligence process in place for new owners coming into ownership at any club, right? So when Newcastle, for example, were taken over, there were a lot of questions about the motivations of the owners, why are they investing, etc. And I think what was found was they actually had very good intentions for the club, right? Given football is so woven into the fabric of the community everywhere locally, right? I think it's very important that this due diligence continues to happen. Now, that's the first thing that will prevent what you're talking about, which is it should weed out potential owners who want to use it for personal financial gain. And the second point you said is absolutely valid, which is Manchester United were a rare asset at that point in time. If you think about when the Glazers bought it, Manchester United were the best club in the Premier League. They were obviously doing reasonably well in Europe. Sir Alex was, again, at the helm and making sure that they had the best players, Ronaldo, Rooney, etc. Right? So it was a good time and they knew they would make a lot of money from it. Right? So the cash generation potential was significant. They'd also seen a lot of what they'd done with the franchises that they own in America, and they saw that potential in football. So they realized that this whole idea of really revamping commercial ownership, having different sponsors in different geographies, different sponsors for different products. I mean, Manchester United have an instant noodles partner, John, in Southeast Asia, right? Like, I don't know any other football club that has an instant noodles sponsorship partner. And why, more importantly? But hey, it's revenue, right, that they're generating and they can take out as dividends. So I think the Glazers were savvy in the way that they operated. So to answer your question, I think that I think is fair to kind of give them that. But I also think that with the new processes in place, I don't think we'll see it. I don't think we'll see owners being able to come in and just use a football club for personal gain anymore. And that's a good thing.
Well, let's move on to another club who have been pretty interesting over the last year in particular, and that is Barcelona. So Barcelona were the flavour of the month last summer because they were the most interesting club from a financial point of view. And I think a lot of this boils down to this idea that Barcelona are in a certain degree of financial trouble when it comes to squad building, because they have what is called a squad cost limit imposed upon them by La Liga. And the reality is that La Liga has a preemptive FFP control, which prohibits the registration of players unless you're within a certain limit, which is a little bit different to a lot of other leagues, I think, where actually those are punished after the fact, those FFP misdemeanors. So Barcelona last summer were in a situation where they had to be very careful about their finances in order to be able to register players to appear for them in the coming season. And it's gone a little bit quiet over at Barcelona, I think, because people are used to the idea now that Barcelona are in that kind of trouble. But what's going on now, Abhishek? Is it still the case, presumably, that that squad cost limit is in play? Barcelona still have to be very careful with their finances in order to register the players that they are bringing in this summer?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it is very much the case that they still need to be quite careful with that. So the latest data, which actually is based on estimates that Barcelona provided La Liga in December last year. So the way it works is Barcelona will provide an estimate to La Liga of how much money they're likely to make this season. La Liga will then use that to set a squad cost limit. So Barcelona per that were actually 200 million euros over the squad cost limit set by La Liga. So they said, look, with the income estimates that Barcelona have submitted, they should have a squad cost of 400 million euros. They actually have a squad cost of over 600 million euros. So they need to bridge a 200 million euro gap. And that gap has actually now led to La Liga basically saying Barcelona will not be able to register new players until they do something about it. I think since then, a few things have happened that are good, which is one, obviously, they won La Liga. So I don't know what they had estimated when they submitted those projections to La Liga. But had they not estimated the La Liga win, they may not have. That's potentially additional income that they weren't planning for. So that naturally raises the allowable limit and cuts into that gap a little bit. The second thing that's happened is high earning players have now left the club. So players like Jordi Alba, Sergio Busquets, especially these two, who were individually actually more than 5% of the total wage bill. So each of them, that is, right? So the fairly sizable wage reductions that have happened there. And Gerard Piqué is retired as well, right? So these are three players who, because they've moved on, that's created further flexibility in that, right? But having said that, John, absolutely, it remains a priority for Barcelona to look for more ways to bridge that gap. They need to bridge that gap. As an example, there are actually players waiting in the wings who don't have professional contracts registered with La Liga yet. So Gavi, for example, who's now a core part of Barcelona's first team, his contract is still a youth contract, right? Because his professional contract has not been registered with La Liga as yet. Ronald Araujo, who they extended to 2026, is actually, again, a very important player. They've not been able to register his contract, right? So these are fairly important young players, critical for the future of the club that they haven't been able to register. So I think they have two choices, the way I see it, in terms of signing new players, right? One is they need to offload players on the squad that aren't playing as much, like in some way or the other. They've done well by offloading some high earners, but I think they need to continue doing that. The second is they need to think about an alternate source of income. Now, last year, obviously, they pulled a number of financial levers, which has been written about extensively, and we can talk about that as well, John, on sort of the sale of future TV rights and the sale of Barca Studios. They're looking at another one of those. So they're basically looking at selling 49% of Barca licensing and merchandising, which to me is, again, risky because you're giving up future revenue for revenue today. But if they do that, that's 300 million pounds that they could potentially get. 300 million euros, sorry. Right? So that's sizable. Again, completely wipes that dent away if they choose to do that. But even if we assume they do nothing and where they are today, I think they will just about be able to register İlkay Gündoğan, which is good because they obviously brought him in. They haven't registered him yet, but now they will be able to. The second important transfer for them is Vitor Roque, but I don't know if they will be able to register him because I think the total cost of that transfer is 45 million euros, and I'm not entirely sure they will be able to absorb that. So based on some back of the envelope math that I did, they have about 50 million euros of flexibility. And based on what I've read online, that's broadly kind of in line, right? If they don't take further steps. Now, obviously, I expect Barcelona to do something about it and take further steps because they do want to remain competitive. You don't want to be in a position where you weaken the team. Again, they underwhelm in the Champions League or they risk losing La Liga, right? Which is, they went through a three-year period where they didn't win La Liga, which was unthinkable almost for Barcelona before 2017-18, I think was the last time they won it before that. So I think Is there a lot of work to be done still? Yes, 100%. There's a lot of work to be done. The club is over $1 billion, actually, €1 billion, sorry, in debt. They are by far, actually, they have the largest gross financial debt of any football club in Europe. They pay the most interest already. And they're actually taking out another loan now. And luckily, it's a long-term loan. So it's actually well-structured. We spoke about that earlier, right? So it's a long-term loan with a good interest rate. But it's a €1.45 billion loan on the stadium to actually like rebuild and invest in the stadium, which is good because it's needed. But again, that will come with its own additional interest burden, right, going forward. So I think that's the first problem. The second problem, as I said, is they're still spending a lot on transfers. And the wage bill is also very high. There's 73% of income now on wages, player wages, player and staff wages alone, which is very high. So if I compare that to a Manchester City, for example, Manchester City are at 57%, so which is much more healthy and gives them a lot more flexibility to do other things, right? So that's sort of the lowdown on where they are. There is still a lot of work to be done. Obviously, the La Liga win was good. It should give them some more flexibility. But that doesn't change the fact that it's papering over cracks that exist, right? And in some cases, they're actually getting wider because the debt's going to go up.
Yeah, so I've got two questions here. I want to ask one about the past and I want to ask one about the future. So in terms of the past, you're talking here about a huge amount of financial gymnastics that Barcelona have to go through every window in order to justify registering players, which is a nightmare for a football club. So how did things end up getting this badly for Barcelona?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. I think it goes back to the 2017-18 season, the start of that season when they sold Neymar to PSG. I think that was the start of it. They made a lot of money on that sale, obviously, and I don't think they spent any of it very well at all, right? So they basically overspent on a bunch of players. So obviously Dembele and Coutinho came in that window. They're the ones that are most talked about. But then there's a whole host of other players they brought into the squad without really thinking about squad balance, roles, where those players would play, without really making enough of an attempt to integrate them. Nelson Semedo, Malcolm, Paulinha. There's so many examples of players that that they brought in at that time that actually just didn't work. Marc Cucurella, Luca Dean, Gary Mina, there's so many. So, and this is actually over multiple seasons. And then they got into this mindset of, okay, we've had a bad year, we didn't win La Liga. Let's make sure we protect the best players, right? And then they signed on players like Lionel Messi, Sergio Busquets, Jordi Alba, Gerard Pique on very expensive contracts in a bid to protect them and tie them down. What that did was it completely messed up the wage structure. So you change the wage cap, you change the wage distribution. It created a lot of squad disharmony. And obviously you took up the absolute squad cost. The other thing they decided to do was they said, look, our transfers haven't worked in the last couple of seasons, but that doesn't mean we should stop. Because if you stop investing in the team, you run the risk of falling further behind. So they almost played a more dangerous gamble by saying, let's actually take debt, like a lot of debt, and let's spend it all on subsequent windows and then see how it goes and actually take stock, right? So Griezmann for £110 million, Frenkie de Jong for £78 million, a lot of examples of that as well that played out in subsequent seasons, right? And I think it's fair to say that most of the transfer decisions actually didn't go as they had planned, or anywhere near actually as they had planned, right? And they sold a lot of those players on a lot. Gerard Deulofeu, for example, to Watford, right? Like so many examples that just roll off the tongue. And that cascaded, John, to a level where when Joan Laporta took over, he actually described Bartomeu's spending as too much and at the speed of light. Right? That's a verbatim quote from him. And when Bartomeu realized that there was no way this was going to work, he actually went to players and tried to get them to negotiate down wages. So imagine how funny this looks, right? You've signed players onto these high wage contracts because you want to lock them down. And a few months later, you go back to them and say, hey, can you actually take a wage cut right now? Because we can't meet La Liga's FFP and I can't register Memphis Depay, for example, right? So obviously the players refused to do it. And it became a very big issue. And then obviously there's accusations that he went ahead and paid a PR agency to badmouth the players, etc. All of this obviously unraveled. And COVID made things a lot worse for Barcelona. So Barcelona were actually one of the worst hit clubs by COVID. Obviously, because firstly, match day income's huge for Barcelona, just given the size of the stadium and the fact that it's full basically for every game. The second reason was the commercial agreements they had effectively they didn't act fast enough to kind of prepare for what COVID was going to bring, and they didn't negotiate the best commercial deals as compared to other clubs. Real Madrid is a good example of actually a club that managed it reasonably well. So because of that, they suffered through the COVID period. And La Liga's FFP, interestingly, John, actually had no allowances for COVID. All the other FFPs did. So the Premier League FFP, for example, allows you to write off pandemic losses, right? Which is why, again, a lot of clubs that have been making losses continue to be able to spend money in the transfer market. La Liga didn't. La Liga actually said FFP remains exactly the same through COVID, which added to Barcelona's problems, right? And ultimately, I think when Laporta took over, he realized there was no way they were actually going to be able to fix this without taking very drastic measures, right? And the measures they took effectively were to give up future revenue, which is by selling a stake, let's say, in their TV rights. It's a strange decision because TV rights are actually going to go up exponentially year on year. You're basically saying, for the next 25 years, I'm giving up 25% of a growing revenue stream because I want that money up front today. Now, they had to do it. They wouldn't have done it unless they had to do it. But because of that actually got them flexibility, right? And they were able to go ahead. And I think what was a little strange was they continued to have that gambling mindset of, let's go buy Lewandowski, let's go buy Rafinha, let's go buy Jules Koundé, right? And let's continue to do what hasn't really worked, but hopefully now with smarter decision makers behind the scenes, right? So Xavi obviously has a very clear idea of how he wants the team to play, the vision he's aiming for, right? And they're backing him, which is probably smart, right? So it remains to be seen whether all of the decisions they've made will work out going ahead. But that's pretty much why it's unraveled and gotten to this situation. That's why they had to let Messi leave. Even after Messi left, they were well over La Liga's limit on the squad cost. So yeah, it's just been a complete unraveling from that point. And I was actually very surprised they were even interested or in conversations for Lionel Messi, because the wage implication of that would have just completely ruled out the possibility of them signing anybody else in the window completely. And they would have also had to let potentially good players go. So in a way, it's actually good financially that didn't happen, because it gives them a little more flexibility to plan better for the future.
Yeah, and I said I've got a second question about the future. From what you're saying, it sounds as though Barcelona are starting to get on top of things. I suppose my question is, how realistic is it as an outcome that they can get through this? Because it seems as though they have to continue being successful in order for their financial situation to get less precarious. So is there a possible world where things don't go well in terms of the on-pitch stuff, and then that will just have a knock-on impact for the off-field stuff?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, John. And that is very much the gamble that they're making, or the bet they've placed, that the investments they've made into the squad to back Xavi, to now work on the stadium, they're all with very much the intent of saying, look, we will be one of the best teams in Europe. That's going to happen. And it's not just about La Liga and winning La Liga. It's about doing well in the Champions League. Now, crashing out of the Champions League in the group stage was actually shocking for Barcelona last year. They hadn't estimated that. They'd actually built the quarterfinals of the Champions League into their financial projections for last year, right? So the fact that they crashed out a lot sooner is a big problem, right? So they're very much betting on the fact that with the players they have, if they continue to smartly invest in the squad, and again, smartly is debatable, but that's the goal. If they continue to do that, they will see the on-pitch results translate into better broadcasting income, for better commercial deals. They'll actually then, it would potentially snowball into, let's make a better stadium. And obviously the stadium will have its own incremental revenue generating potential. So they believe there'll be a snowball effect with better performances on the pitch. And again, this goes back to actually the ethos of Barcelona in many ways, which is, even in the early 2000s, when they felt like it was a challenging time, the way they came out of it was basically to say, let's invest in the squad and let's back a young Pep Guardiola. Let's see where he takes the team, and let's actually push through smart investment or aggressive investment into the squad. And obviously that'll have a longer term cascading effect as we look at our success over the next few years. So they're not a very conservative club, right? If I actually, the good contrast is Arsenal, right? So Arsenal, when they dropped out of the Champions League in 16-17, the first thing they did was they cut the wages, because they realized that there's a chance they won't go back into the Champions League immediately, and there would need to be a period of consolidation, right? Now, what that's allowed Arsenal to do is build a squad smartly. They've taken their time. They've obviously brought in good players from the academy, and the wages are very much under control. And that's enabled their spending now. If you look at the last three windows, Arsenal have gone gangbusters on transfer spending, right? And we'll talk about that as well. But they've been able to do that because they were conservative when they started out. Now, there are arguments both ways, obviously, right? Because the conservative approach is a little bit more longer term. And if the gamble approach works, then it's probably more immediate success and can also lead to financial stability, right? So that's the bet that they're making, John, and you're absolutely right that competitive success is going to be needed.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Well, let's move on to another club who we've also mentioned already, and that is Chelsea. Chelsea, obviously, one of the clubs that have had a recent ownership change. And that ownership has had a very interesting approach to signing players in particular. So let's begin by talking about what Chelsea are doing. They've signed a lot of players. They've signed a lot of players on long contracts, and then they've spent most of this summer selling a lot of players on as well. So what's your take on Chelsea and the way that they've approached particularly the buying market?
I think the first thing I have to say there is I'm pretty surprised actually at the levels of spending, because Clear Lake Capital, who co-invested with Boley, are actually known to be pretty conservative investors, right, as an investment firm. So I'm very surprised that they've been so aggressive so far. I mean, to put it in context, Chelsea spent £540 million in the last two transfer windows, which is the 22-23 season. That's actually more than their revenue, John, in a year, right? Which is an alarming amount to actually spend on transfers. Now, I think the first thing that needs to be talked about in the context of Chelsea is player amortization and impairment. That's really the thing that people have, it's the buzzword associated with Chelsea these days. And I think it's super significant as well. So what are these two things, right? Firstly, player amortization basically means you take a transfer fee and you divide it over the duration of a player's contract. So how did Chelsea use this to their advantage? They basically signed players on much longer contracts so that the annual charge of that player in their profit and loss statement is that much smaller. So it's like saying if I paid £50 million for a player on a 2-year contract, that's £25 million a year in my profit and loss statement that I have to write off as an expense. If I sign a player for £50 million on a 5-year contract, that's actually just £10 million a year that I need to write off each year in my financials, right? So Mykhailo Mudryk, for example, was signed for £88 million on an 8.5-year contract, which has actually never been done before. It's one of the longest contracts ever that a player has been signed for. And effectively, that's £10.4 million a year, right? Which is, to Chelsea's credit, they saw a loophole and they tried to take advantage of it. Now, UEFA have obviously clamped down on that. They've said now that you can't have more than 5-year contract. I mean, however long you sign a player for, you can amortize over a 5-year period. You can't actually amortize over the duration of the entire contract, which is good. Again, it keeps this kind of manipulation, if I can call it that, or intelligent accounting, let's call it that way, right? It keeps it in check. The second thing to talk about is player impairment. What that actually means, John, is let's say I sign you, right, for my football club, and I paid £40 million for John McKenzie.
I don't like where this is going, because I know that the impairment is not a good thing, right?
So let's say I sign Joe Devine for £40 million.
Yeah, there we go. That's much better.
Yeah, let's use that. So Joe Devine, £40 million on a 4-year contract.
That's too much for Joe, I think. That's too much for Joe.
It's a bit too much. It's a bit pricey, but that's
okay. Can we do it in 20?
Let's do it in 20. That works well. So let's say I sign Joe for £20 million on a 4-year contract, right? 2 years into it, Joe, I've written off 10 million of the transfer spend that I've done on Joe, but he's still worth 10 million on my books, right? Now I realize Joe's actually not worth 10 million at all. He's probably worth more like 2 million, right? I can choose at the end of year two to just write off 8 million more of Joe's contract. And what that enables for me is going forward in years 3 and 4, I'm actually only taking out £1 million each year, right? Instead of the 5 that I would have had to, right? So it's almost like it's an accounting fix that allows you to plan ahead for more amortization that's likely to happen in the future. The reason why this is relevant for Chelsea is Chelsea already have, even before the Todd Boehly signings, right? So even before all of their money was spent, they had the highest player amortization in the Premier League. So Chelsea's annual amortization charge is £160 million as per their latest financials, right? Now, this doesn't include any of the Todd Boehly signings, right? So they know this number is going to go up. It absolutely has to with the multitude of players that have come in, right? So what they've done is they've taken a £77 million impairment loss this year because they know that £160 million is actually going to go up. And why have they done it this year? Because they had Champions League income last year, right? So they could offset the impairment loss with the income last year. Next year, they know they knew probably at that point that there is a good chance they don't have the European TV money, they don't have the European prize money, they don't have European income, right? Now that gives you a lot less leeway to actually play with impairment at that point. So they've taken the impairment because they know the amortization is going to go up and the income is going to go down, right? So that's the first thing to note with Chelsea is they use amortization and impairment very liberally, right? To manage to fit all the players into the squad. The second thing to note with Chelsea is they use youth player sales to actually offset losses. And they've done this consistently now, right? So the one thing Chelsea actually do quite well is because they have a strong youth academy, they actually make a lot of money through player sales, right? Now, how player sales actually generate money for football clubs is also worth noting, John. So basically, let's go back to the example. Right? I buy Joe Devine for £20 million. 2 years into his contract, he's worth £10 million. Let's say somebody comes in and says, I want to buy Joe Devine for £15 million. I make £5 million on Joe Devine. I don't make 15, right? 15 is what somebody paid for him, but I had 10 on my books anyway. So basically, my net gain there is just £5 million. Now, let's say there was a youth player. Let's say Joe Devine was a youth academy player who I signed into the senior team, right? And then I sold him on for £20 million or £15 million, whatever. Let's assume it's 15, right? The same price. I actually earned £15 million on Joe Devine now, right? Because he was a youth academy player. So I signed him for effectively zero into the main team, which is why when I look at Chelsea and I look at the sales of players like Tammy Abraham, right? Last season, even before we get to Mason Mount, right? So Tammy Abraham last season, Loftus-Cheek potentially now, right? Mason Mount, all of these players are going to generate a lot of direct income for Chelsea, right? And the reason why that's relevant, John, is because that gives them more flexibility again to actually manage financial fair play, right? And it's important to talk about Premier League financial fair play as well a little bit. So financial fair play in the Premier League is a tricky concept. Basically, it means over a three-year period, a club cannot make more than 15 million in losses, right? Now, you'd be surprised at that number, right? So what is 15 million? That's a small number. A lot of clubs make more losses than that. This number can go up to actually 105 million cumulatively over 3 years if 90 million is actually provided by owners through secured funding. Now, secured funding means no loans, right? It just means you invest more into the club. You would not be surprised to know Todd Boehly and Clear Lake have done that at Chelsea, right, already. So basically, their limit is 105 million of loss over 3 years. The thing that makes these 3 years particularly complicated as well is COVID, right? So the Premier League also made exceptions for COVID. They basically said you can write off losses for COVID. That's fine. Like, you don't need to worry about it. So if you imagine there are massive losses that Premier League clubs have written off in 2021, 2022, which is primarily the COVID seasons, you're basically now looking at more flexibility, right? They're 105 million. They're nowhere near that 105 million FFP limit, right? So a lot of questions that might be natural here is how can Chelsea keep buying players? They actually can because they're not very close to that limit. Why this summer matters more is because now we move into next year, and actually next year, the COVID years go away, right? So actually I got that wrong. It's 1920 and 2021. Those are the two COVID years. So next year when I move and when we do the same 3 year period check, you're actually suddenly out of the COVID period, right? In some sense, or one of the years is in, one of the years is out. So the losses that you were able to write off now are a lot less, right? So you need to actually be smart about investment, which is also why Chelsea are now focusing on sales, right? And the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has been very kind there and has actually enabled a lot of sales, right, for Chelsea, which is great because what that's allowed them to do again is created more flexibility to go out and, let's say, buy a Moises Caicedo, right? If they wanted to do that. They would never have been able to do it without that flexibility, right? But I do think that there will be an end to this crazy spending. I don't think Chelsea can keep doing this because I think Clear Lake Capital are very clear as investors that they want to see financial return, right? So they're not they're not the typical investor who, let's say, doesn't really mind if a football club generates financial return as long as it's winning on the pitch, and then we'll see about the financial return later, right? Because they are an investment firm, they want to see financial return and fairly quickly, right? So over a 4 or 5 year period. So I would be surprised if they go gangbusters again, unless they manage to offload a lot of the squad. So I know that was a long answer, John, but hopefully that captures a lot of the nuances around Chelsea, what they're trying to do, why all of this accounting jugglery is actually important for us as fans to and people who watch the game keenly to understand and know about.
Yeah, and just a quick question on that, because we mentioned before when we were talking about Manchester United that a lot of American investors consider football clubs to be assets that will bring them profits in the long term. Do you think that Todd Boehly and Clear Lake Capital will have changed their attitude to that now, having spent a season having to deal with some of the financial difficulties that football club ownership brings?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, and probably one that they are better suited to answer, to be honest. But I definitely think they would have understood what they're up against a little bit more closely now, because it's actually a lot more complicated. I don't think new owners, especially American owners who've kind of owned American sports franchises, actually understand how complicated owning Premier League football clubs or any football club actually in Europe is, because of firstly, the number of financial regulations, let's call them regulations, call them guidelines, that you need to navigate. And secondly, that you're actually taking bets here, right? And those bets may not come off. Like, for example, when they brought in Graham Potter, they actually paid a lot of money to Brighton to do that. So, John, interestingly, Chelsea spent, I think, almost £45 million on literally on manager changes, right, in the last year. So £10 million was Thomas Tuchel's compensation when he was let go. They paid £21 million to Brighton to get Graham Potter, and then £13 million to Graham Potter when he left, right? So that's a lot of money just on managerial changes, right? So I think they've realized that having the right guy leading the team is important. The second thing I think that they've realized is in the Premier League, every team actually has considerably good funding, considerably good earning potential, because the broadcasting income in the Premier League is just so high, right? So all of those teams are competitive in the transfer market, right? And it's actually not going to be taken for granted that Chelsea finish in the top six, top seven, top eight, because all those teams are making smart investments. They have good managers, right? And the standard has just gone up. And now, having finished in the bottom half, they've realized broadcasting income is going to go down because they're not going to be in Europe, right? And that's the other thing that's important for Chelsea, John, actually, right? Is if I look at their revenue growth, it's 8% in the last 3 years, but it's all broadcasting income. Match day and commercial income is flat, right? And the reason why that happened is because they won the Champions League. So if you win the Champions League, your UEFA coefficient goes up. You get a lot more TV money, both in that season and the next season. Now they're no longer in Europe. So the UEFA coefficient is going to drop. They won't obviously have any TV money from Europe next year. They won't have as much Premier League TV money from last year because they finished in the bottom half. So there are a lot of problems, right, from a revenue generation potential that they will need to think about, which is why they've been a little more cautious in this window. And I think they absolutely need the Pochettino appointment to work, because if it doesn't work, right, firstly, again, you have a fairly disjointed squad, which has been put together by multiple owners over multiple windows. And secondly, you're actually going down a path where you're paying a very massive wage bill and your revenue generation potential is actually dropping, right? And Chelsea's wage to revenue is actually quite high. It's 71%, which is pretty high for a top six club. It's I think, only lower. In fact, I think it's the highest of the top six club, Premier League top six clubs, right? So it's actually important for Chelsea to think about this right now. And therefore, it's probably a smarter approach to be a little more cautious, get these sales done, get the money in from those sales, and then think about investing in the squad. Having said that, if the Pochettino appointment works, absolutely, it's all hunky-dory, right? Because as we said, that will create a cascading effect on commercial income, TV income, a lot of things going forward.
So from one London club that's spending a lot of money in the transfer market to another London club that's spending a lot of money in the transfer market, albeit having a lot more success on the field, let's talk a little bit about Arsenal. So the big stories with Arsenal at the moment is their spending spree this summer. So Kai Havertz for £160 million is guaranteed. Declan Rice is not quite over the line yet, but they've agreed a fee of £100 plus £5 million. And then Urien Timber is expected to be signing at around €40 million with an additional €5 million in add-ons. So in total, if everything goes to plan, and as at the time of recording, that is not the case, but it is looking likely that it will be the case, it does seem as though Arsenal will be spending around £200 million this summer. So the big question, I suppose, is how can Arsenal afford to do this?
Absolutely. And in fact, if I go a little further back, John, they've spent about £300 million in the last 2 years. So if you add that up, it's £500 million over three seasons, right? Which is huge. How have Arsenal been able to do this? I think a few reasons that explain it, right? And I know there have been questions about FFP or why are Arsenal not closer to FFP? Arsenal are miles away from being in any kind of FFP trouble, right? And I'll try and explain why that is. Firstly, Arsenal's wages are actually very well managed, as I said earlier, right? So they're basically at a £212 million wage bill, which is 170 million, just to put it in context, 170 million pounds lower than Manchester United. Manchester United is 384 million pounds. Arsenal's is 212. So that gives them a lot of flexibility on wages to actually like bring players in at good wages, renew the contracts of players like Bukayo Saka, Gabriel Martinelli, who are important for the future of the club at higher wages. It gives them a lot of wage flexibility. That's the first point. The second point is because they're back in the Champions League, earning potential goes up significantly for various reasons for Arsenal. Firstly, their title sponsor is Emirates, obviously, right, both the stadium and the shirt. And Emirates actually have built into their sponsorship contract a clause that says if Arsenal play in the Champions League, they get a bigger payout. And they get that payout immediately at the start of the season. So they will earn a lot of money literally without even kicking a ball in the Champions League. Second, the actual Champions League group stage is about 30, 40 million in euros, right? Which is great. And that's just for participating, assuming Arsenal don't go further, which they very easily could. The third thing, which is worthy of note, is Arsenal's amortization is still only the fourth highest in the Premier League, right? So we spoke about Chelsea being the highest, Arsenal still the fourth highest, right? Now, obviously, it'll go up more now when they sign or complete all the signings in this window, but it's still at a fairly manageable level, I would say, right? It's not gone completely off the handle. I think the one thing that Arsenal have faced as an issue and really need to think about is revenue growth, right? So if I look at the last 5 years, 2017 to 22, Arsenal's revenues actually declined by 13% in that period, right? So it was £423 million in 2017. It's £369 million in 2022. Now, in comparison, if I look at Tottenham Hotspur, for example, their biggest rivals, they actually grew revenue by 45% in the same period, right? And Tottenham actually went from having literally 40% less revenue than Arsenal to 20% more now, right? And a big part of that is actually commercial revenue, where Arsenal are actually the commercial engine is much weaker, I would say, than the other Premier League clubs. And that's something that they need to invest in and push further. Now that they have Champions League qualification, I imagine they will 100% be doing that. But commercial revenue for Spurs now is 30% higher than Arsenal, right? Which is interesting because it was lower in 2017, right? So again, Spurs have managed to accelerate very quickly. And you look at all the other clubs, Man City, Liverpool, even Manchester United's commercial revenue is well above Arsenal's, right? So that's the first step, is how do we actually build commercial revenue as a very meaningful stream of revenue, right? We spoke about revenue mix earlier. Arsenal actually have the highest reliance on match day income, right? 24%. So they were actually very affected by COVID again, because very high reliance on match day income, which basically went to zero during COVID. So right now, Arsenal are in a good position to spend heavily, John, also because, again, so as I add these things up, one, Champions League qualification will have a snowball effect on revenue. Second, their wage bill is actually very low, so it gives them a lot of flexibility to sign players on higher wages. The third thing is the Premier League FFP COVID regulations, which we spoke about, right? So because Arsenal had such heavy losses during COVID, they can basically write off massive amounts of losses and they're nowhere near the FFP limit, right? So Arsenal's pre-tax loss was, I think, the cumulative loss was £160 million or so, if I look at the data over the last 3 years. And their COVID losses are actually estimated at being pretty much that. So they can effectively wipe out the entire thing, and that gives them £105 million of flexibility, right, to spend. Now, remember, this is a cumulative loss. So obviously, there are other elements that kind of come into it. But because they have that COVID flexibility now, and they won't have it, as we discussed earlier, right, next season, this is the right time, if you think about it, for Arsenal to actually go big and really strengthen the squad. I don't expect Arsenal to continue doing this in subsequent seasons. I don't think they will need to, actually, because they've kind of built, again, a very young squad, a very good squad. If they tie players down to long-term contracts, I think it's a very well set up, well-structured squad. And it will not need, that's what they're banking on, it will not need significant further investment going forward. So I actually think Arsenal are fairly well placed financially, and therefore there's actually no danger of violating FFP or even getting close to it, despite all the spending we've seen.
Yeah, so we talked before about Barcelona when they dropped out of the Champions League, that being an issue. And you said that Arsenal were actually quite conservative when they fell out of the Champions League spots. How much of this now is about them cementing their place in the top four for the next, in their, I guess, in their hopes, decade or so?
Absolutely. I think it's 100% about that, John. But I also think, just given Mikel Arteta's standards as a manager, he's probably thinking, how do we just absolutely get better versus last year? So how do we get more points? How do we score more goals? How do we potentially challenge even more closely, right, for the title? If they were that close last year and nobody expected them to be, this season, they actually have a better squad now. They've brought in one of the best defensive midfielders in the world. They're bringing in Jurrien Timber, who offers them a lot of flexibility in many different positions, right? And I think they've been smart with the way that they've recruited, right? So if I look at Martin Odegaard, for example, Ben White, all of these guys, there was a lot of money spent. Aaron Ramsdale, for example, which was questioned at the time, but they've actually been embedded into the squad really well and have actually fit into the plan very, very, very effectively, right? And I think the one transfer that intrigued me was Kai Havertz. So I'm interested to see how they kind of fit him in, but I'm sure there's a plan, right? So absolutely, you're right that it's now about cementing their place in the top four. But I also think, just given Arteta's ambition as a manager and his pursuit of excellence, I think this is also about the title, actually, right? And I think he's realized that this is a window where they've brought in seriously high quality talent to push that to that extra level, right? Last season, there were a couple of injuries. Obviously, Zinchenko was injured, Xhaka was injured for a bit. So they didn't actually get the full squad firing through the season as often as they may have liked to, despite what Erik ten Hag's been saying. But this season, I think they actually have the depth as well, right? So if I look at that squad, that this is a squad that should be challenging, not just for the title, but potentially to do well in the Champions League as well. So yes, you're right. I think it is about that conservative. I'm sure the owners are still a little bit more conservative in that sense of saying, look, let's cement top four. Let's make sure that we make sure we never drop out of there again, right? But equally, I also think there's a lot of ambition now. And it's actually moved from, hey, we've been conservative. We've managed our finances well. Let's now see how we can be a little bit more aggressive and push this. Because I actually think that's healthy in a way as well, right? Because if you're aggressive, you can actually push it and it drives more growth going forward.
Well, Abby, I could talk to you about football finances for days, months, years, but we do have to draw this to a close. It's been great having you on. I've got you down on Twitter as at Abby Psych Raj, so ABHIPSYCHRAJ. I know you have an Instagram account as well where you post videos regularly as well. And if our listeners haven't had enough of you by that point, you also do a lot of writing for us over at TIFO as well. So thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you so much for having me, John. It's been an absolute pleasure. And excited to work with you guys more going forward.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.